Chapter 15. How Not to Die from Iatrogenic Causes, or How Not to Die from Doctors. As the saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's quaint, but a pound isn't all that heavy. Why change your diet and lifestyle when you can just let modern medicine do its job of fixing you back up? Unfortunately, modern medicine isn't nearly as effective as most people think. Doctors excel at treating acute conditions, such as mending broken bones, curing infections, but for chronic diseases, which are the leading cause of death and disability, conventional medicine doesn't have much to offer, and in fact can sometimes do more harm than good. For example, side effects from medications given in hospitals kill an estimated 106,000 Americans every year. That statistic alone effectively makes medical care the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. And this number reflects only the number of deaths from taking the drugs as prescribed. An additional 7,000 people die every year from receiving the wrong medication by mistake, and 20,000 others die from other hospital errors. Hospitals are dangerous places. And that's not even counting the estimated 99,000 deaths each year due to hospital-acquired infections. But can deaths from infections be blamed on doctors? They can if doctors won't even wash their hands. We've known since the 1840s that hand washing is the best way to prevent hospital-acquired infections, yet compliance among healthcare workers rarely exceeds 50%. And doctors are the worst offenders. One study found that even in a medical intensive care unit, slapping up a contact precaution sign, which signals particularly high risk of infection, leads less than a quarter of doctors to properly wash their hands or use a hand sanitizer when treating patients. That's right, not even one doctor out of four washes his or her hands before laying them on the ill. Many physicians are concerned that should it become widely known how many people doctors inadvertently kill every year, it could, quote-unquote, undermine public trust. But if doctors can't even be bothered to wash their hands, how much trust do we deserve? This unfortunate and gross situation means that you could go in for a simple operation and come out with a life-threatening infection, if you come out at all. Every year, 12,000 Americans die from complications due to surgeries that weren't even necessary in the first place. For those keeping score, that's more than 200,000 people dead from so-called iatrogenic causes, from the ancient Greek iatros, meaning doctor. And that figure is based only on the data on hospitalized patients. In outpatient settings, for instance, at your doctor's office, prescription drug side effects alone may result in 199,000 additional deaths. The Institute of Medicine estimates that medical errors may kill even more Americans, up to 98,000, bringing the total annual death count closer to 300,000. That's more than the entire populations of cities like Newark, Buffalo, or Orlando. Even using more conservative estimates of deaths due to medical errors, healthcare comes in as the real third leading cause of death in America. How did the medical community respond to such a damning conclusion? Deafening silence in both word and deed. The first such report, which appeared in 1978, suggested that about 120,000 deaths occurring in hospitals could be prevented. Then, 16 years later, another scathing reminder was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, suggesting the iatrogenic death toll may be, quote, the equivalent of three jumbo jet crashes every 2 days, unquote. In the years between these two reports, as many as nearly 2 million Americans may have died due to medical errors, yet the medical community refused to comment on this tragedy and made no substantial effort to reduce the number of deaths. Another estimated 600,000 deaths later, the prestigious Institute of Medicine released its own landmark report on the catastrophic consequences of medical error, but again, little was done as a result. Eventually, a few changes were implemented. For instance, interns and residents could no longer be made to work more than 80 hours a week, at least on paper, and shifts couldn't be more than 30 consecutive hours long. That may not sound like a big step, but when I started my internship after graduating from medical school, we worked 36-hour shifts. Combined with our other days of work, that added up to a 117-hour work week. When interns and residents are forced to pull all-nighters, studies suggest they make 36% more serious medical errors, 5 times more diagnostic errors, and have twice as many quote-unquote attentional failures, such as nodding off during surgery. The patient is supposed to be asleep during surgery, not the surgeon. It's no surprise, then, that overworked doctors may cause 300% more fatigue-related medical errors that lead to patient death. If every single day airliners crashed and killed hundreds of people, we would expect the Federal Aviation Administration to step in and do something. Why doesn't anyone confront the medical profession? Instead of just releasing reports, entities like the Institute of Medicine could have demanded that doctors and hospitals adopt at least a minimum set of preventive practices, such as barcoding drugs to avoid mix-ups. You know, something they even do on a package of Twinkies at the grocery store? Only people on medications are killed by medication errors or the drug side effects, though. You have to actually be in the hospital to be killed by a hospital error or get an infection there. The good news is that most visits to doctors are for diseases that can be prevented with a healthy diet and lifestyle. The best way to avoid the adverse effects of medical tests and treatments is not to avoid doctors, but to avoid getting sick in the first place. Radiation. There are risks associated not only with medical treatment, but also sometimes with diagnosis. A paper entitled "Estimated Risks of Radiation-Induced Fatal Cancer from Pediatric CT," out of Columbia University in 2001, reignited long-standing concerns about the risks associated with medical diagnostic radiation exposure. CT, or CAT scans, use multiple X-rays from different angles to create cross-sectional images, exposing the body to hundreds of times more radiation than a simple X-ray. Based on the excess cancer risk of Hiroshima survivors exposed to similar doses of radiation, it was estimated that out of all children who undergo abdominal or head CTs every year, 500 might ultimately die from cancer attributable to the CT radiation. In response to this revelation, the editor-in-chief of a leading radiology journal conceded, quote, "We radiologists may be as guilty as others when it comes to not watching out for children," unquote. The risk of developing cancer after a single CT scan may be as high as 1 in 150 for a baby girl. In general, the diagnostic medical radiation dealt out in 1 year is estimated to cause 2,800 breast cancers among American women, as well as 25,000 other cancers. In other words, doctors may be causing tens of thousands of cancers every year. Patients undergoing these scans are rarely informed of these risks. For example, did you know that getting a chest CT scan is estimated to inflict the same cancer risk as smoking 700 cigarettes? One in every 270 middle-aged women may develop cancer due to a single angiogram. CT scans and X-rays can be life-saving, but good evidence suggests that 1/5 to 1/2 of all CT scans aren't necessary at all and could be replaced with a safer type of imaging or simply not performed at all. Many people express concern about the radiation exposure from the full-body scanners at airports using backscatter X-rays, but those machines have been since phased out. The airplane itself, however, is a different story. Because you're exposed to more cosmic rays from outer space at higher altitudes, just one round-trip cross-country flight may subject you to about the same level of radiation as the chest X-ray. Given my past speaking schedule, I should be glowing in the dark by now. Is there anything you can do to mediate the radiation risk? As with so many other health questions, the answer is that you can eat healthfully. In an investigation funded by the National Cancer Institute, researchers studied the diets and chromosome integrity of airline pilots who get zapped with radiation daily to see which foods might be protective. They found that pilots who consumed the most dietary antioxidants suffered the least amount of DNA damage to their bodies. Note the word dietary. Antioxidant supplements, such as vitamin C and E, didn't seem to work. Patients who consumed the most vitamin C through fruits and vegetables, though, appeared to be protected. Taking antioxidant supplements may be more than just a waste of money. People given 500 milligrams of vitamin C a day were found to end up with more oxidative DNA damage. Remember that natural antioxidants in food work synergistically. It's the combination of many different compounds working together that tends to protect you, not high doses of a single antioxidant found in supplements. Indeed, those pilots eating a mix of phytonutrients, concentrated in a variety of such plant foods as citrus, nuts, seeds, pumpkins, and peppers, had the lowest levels of DNA damage in response to the radiation they were bombarded with every day from the galaxy. The research team found that green leafy vegetables like spinach and kale appeared to have an edge over the other fruits and vegetables when it came to radiation protection. All this time I've been packing kale chips on flights just because they're so lightweight, but it turns out they may be protecting my DNA. The same plant-based protection enjoyed by pilots was also found among atomic bomb survivors. For several decades, researchers have followed 36,000 survivors of the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those who ate vegetable or fruit-rich diets appeared to cut their cancer risk by about 36%. We saw the same thing in the aftermath of the accident at the Chernobyl nuclear reaction in Ukraine, where consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables apparently protected children's immune systems, while egg and fish consumption was associated with a significantly increased risk of DNA damage. The researchers suggest this result could have been due to the possibility that the animal foods they ate were contaminated with radioactive elements, or the role of animal fats in free radical formation. Nuclear events offer a rare opportunity to study these effects on humans, since obviously it's unethical to intentionally expose people to radiation. However, as we've learned from declassified documents about U.S. Cold War radiation experiments, this didn't stop our government from injecting quote-unquote colored people with plutonium or feeding so-called retarded children radioactive isotopes in their breakfast cereal. Despite the Pentagon's insistence that these methods were the only feasible means of developing ways to protect people from radiation, researchers have since come up with a few methods that don't violate the Nuremberg Code. One is to study human cells in a test tube. Researchers found, for example, that white blood cells blasted with gamma rays suffered less DNA damage when the cells had been pre-treated with phytonutrients from ginger root. The ginger compounds protected DNA nearly as well as the leading radiation sickness drug at 150 times lower the dose. Those taking ginger in order to prevent motion sickness during air travel may be protecting themselves against more than just nausea. Other common foods that may be protective against radiation damage include garlic, turmeric, goji berries, and mint leaves, but none of these have been tested in clinical studies. How can we test the protective power of foods in people rather than petri dishes? To study how diet may protect against cosmic rays, airline pilots were studied. Guess who they studied to see if foods could be protective against X-rays? X-ray technicians. Hospital workers who routinely operate X-ray machines have been found to suffer more chromosomal damage and have higher levels of oxidative stress compared to other hospital workers. For this reason, researchers recruited a group of X-ray techs and asked them to drink 2 cups of lemon balm tea each day for a month. Lemon balm is an herb in the mint family. Even in that short time frame, the lemon balm tea appeared able to boost the levels of antioxidant enzymes in the subject's bloodstream while also reducing the amount of DNA damage they suffered. The actual benefit of diet versus drugs. Based on a study of more than 100,000 Minnesotans, it appears that 7 out of 10 people may be prescribed at least one prescription drug in any given year. More than half are prescribed 2 or more drugs, and 20% are prescribed 5 or more medications. All told, physicians dispense about 4 billion prescriptions for drugs every year in the United States. That's about 13 prescriptions each year for every man, woman, and child. The two prescription drugs most often brought up in doctors' visits are simvastatin, a cholesterol-lowering medication, and lisinopril, a blood pressure pill. So a lot of drugs are being doled out in an attempt to prevent disease. But how well are these billions of pills working? An overconfidence in the power of pills and procedures for disease prevention may be one of the reasons doctors and patients alike may undervalue diet and lifestyle interventions. When surveyed, people tend to wildly overestimate the ability of mammograms and colonoscopies to prevent cancer deaths, or the power of drugs like Fosamax to prevent hip fractures, or drugs like Lipitor to prevent fatal heart attacks. Patients believe cholesterol-lowering statin drugs are about 20 times more effective than they actually are in preventing heart attacks. No wonder most people continue to rely on drugs to save them. But the dirty little secret is that most people surveyed said they would not be willing to take many of these drugs if they knew how little benefit these products actually offered. How ineffectual are some of the most common drugs in America? When it comes to cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood-thinning drugs, the chance of even high-risk patients benefiting from them is typically less than 5% over a period of 5 years. When asked, most patients say they want to be told the truth. However, as doctors, we know that if we divulge this information, few of our patients would agree to take these drugs every day for the rest of their lives, which would be detrimental for the small percentage of people who do truly benefit from them. That's why doctors in the know and drug companies oversell the benefits by conveniently not mentioning how tiny those benefits actually are. When it comes to chronic disease management, practicing conventional medicine can be thought of as practicing deceptive medicine. For the hundreds of millions of people on these drugs who don't benefit, it's not simply a matter of all the money spent and all the side effects endured. To me, the true tragedy is all the lost opportunities to address the root causes of patients' conditions. When people dramatically overestimate how much their prescription pills protect them, they may be less likely to do the dietary changes necessary to dramatically lower their risk. Take cholesterol-lowering statin drugs, for example. The best they may be able to offer in terms of absolute risk reduction for a subsequent heart attack or death is about 3% over 6 years. Meanwhile, a whole food plant-based diet may work 20 times better, potentially offering an absolute risk reduction of 60% after fewer than 4 years. In 2014, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn Jr. published a case series of about 200 people with significant heart disease, showing that a healthy enough plant-based diet may prevent further major cardiac episodes in 99.4% of patients who follow it. You don't really have the luxury of choosing between following a healthy diet or taking a pill to prevent a heart attack, because pills may not work in the near term in 97% of the cases. Of course, diet and drugs are not mutually exclusive, and many under Dr. Esselstyn's care wisely continue to take their cardiac meds. You just need to have a realistic understanding of how limited a role the contents of your medicine cabinets play compared to the contents of your refrigerator. Heart disease may continue to be the number one killer of men, women, and eventually our children if doctors continue to rely on drugs and stents. However, if you eat a healthy enough diet, you may be able to reverse the stranglehold it has on your heart. That is something doctors can be proud to divulge to our patients. Aspirin. How well do over-the-counter drugs perform? For example, take aspirin. Perhaps the most commonly used medication in the world has been around in pill form for over a century. Its active ingredient, salicylic acid, has been used in its natural form as an extract of willow tree bark to ease pain and fever for thousands of years. One of the reasons it remains so popular, despite the fact that better anti-inflammatory painkillers exist now, is that it's used by millions of people on a daily basis as a blood thinner to reduce the risk of a heart attack. As we heard about in the beginning of the audiobook, heart attacks often occur when a blood clot forms in response to a ruptured atherosclerotic plaque in one of our coronary arteries. taking aspirin may help stop this from happening. Aspirin may also lower the risk of cancer. It works by suppressing an enzyme within your body that creates proclotting factors, thereby thinning your blood. At the same time, aspirin suppresses pro-inflammatory compounds called prostaglandins, which in turn reduces pain, swelling, and fever. Prostaglandins may also dilate the lymph vessels inside tumors, potentially allowing cancer cells to spread. One of the ways scientists think aspirin helped prevent cancer deaths is by counteracting a tumor's attempts to pry open the lymphatic bars on its cage and spread throughout the body. So should everyone take a quote-unquote baby-strength aspirin a day? Note that aspirin should never actually be given to infants or children. No. The problem is that aspirin can cause side effects. The same blood-thinning benefit that can prevent a heart attack can also cause a hemorrhagic stroke, in which you bleed into your brain. Aspirin can also damage the lining of the digestive tract. For those who've already had a heart attack and continue to eat the same diet that led to the first one, and are therefore at exceedingly high risk of having another one, the risk-benefit analysis seems clear. Taking aspirin would probably prevent about 6 times more serious problems than it causes you. But among the general population who have yet to have their first heart attack, the risks and benefits are more closely matched. Thus, taking an aspirin a day is generally not recommended. Throw in even a 10% reduction in cancer mortality, though, and it may tip the risk-benefit balance in favor of aspirin. Given that regular low-dose aspirin use may reduce the risk of cancer mortality by a third, it is tempting to recommend it for nearly everyone. If only we could get the benefits without the risks. Well, maybe you can. The willow tree isn't the only plant that contains salicylic acid. It's widely found in many of the fruits and vegetables in the plant kingdom. That's why you often find the active ingredient of aspirin in the bloodstreams of people who aren't even taking it. The more fruits and vegetables you eat, the higher your level of salicylic acid may rise. In fact, the levels of people eating plant-based diets actually overlap with those of some people taking low-dose aspirin. You might think plant eaters would have higher ulcer rates, because aspirin is known to chew away at the gut. But those following plant-based diets actually appear to have a significantly lower risk of ulcers. How is that possible? Because in plants, the salicylic acid may come naturally prepackaged with gut-protective nutrients. For example, nitric oxide from dietary nitrates exerts stomach protective effects by boosting blood flow and protective mucus production in the lining of the stomach, effects which demonstrably oppose the pro-ulcerative impact of aspirin. So, for the general population, by eating plants instead of taking aspirin, individuals may not only get aspirin's benefits without the risks, but also get the benefits with benefits. People who've had a heart attack should follow their physician's advice, which probably includes taking aspirin every day. But what about everyone else? I think everyone should be on aspirin, but in the form of produce, not a pill. The salicylic acid content in plants may help explain why traditional plant-based diets were so protective. For instance, before their diets were westernized, animal products made up only about 5% of the average Japanese diet. During this period in the 1950s, age-adjusted death rates from colon, prostate, breast, and ovarian cancers were 5 to 10 times lower in Japan than in the United States, while incidences of pancreatic cancer, leukemia, and lymphoma were 3 to 4 times lower. This phenomenon was not unique to the Japanese. As we've heard throughout this audiobook, rates of cancers and heart disease have been found to be dramatically lower among populations whose diets centered around plant foods. If part of this protection arises from aspirin phytonutrients, which plants in particular are packed with the stuff? While salicylic acid is ubiquitously present in fruits and vegetables, herbs and spices contain the highest concentrations. Chili powder, paprika, and turmeric are rich in the compound, but cumin has the most per serving. Indeed, just 1 teaspoon of ground cumin may be about the equivalent of a baby aspirin. This may help explain why India, with its spice-rich diets, has among the lowest worldwide rates of colorectal cancer, the cancer that appears most sensitive to the effects of aspirin. And the spicier, the better. A spicy vegetable vindaloo has been calculated to contain 4 times the salicylic acid content of a milder Madras-style veggie dish. eat a single meal, and you could get the same spike in salicylic acid in your bloodstream as if you took an aspirin. The benefits of salicylic acid are another reason you should strive to choose organic produce. Because the plant uses the compound as a defense hormone, its concentration may be increased when that plant is bitten by bugs. Pesticide-laden plants aren't nibbled as much, and perhaps as a result appear to produce less salicylic acid. For example, in one study, soup made from organic vegetables was found to contain nearly 6 times more salicylic acid than soup prepared from conventional, non-organically grown ingredients. Another way to get more salicylic acid bang for your buck is by opting for whole foods. Whole grain breads, for example, not only offer more salicylic acid, but may contain 100 times more phytochemicals in general than white bread, reportedly 800 compared to approximately 8. Attention has been focused on salicylic acid because of the voluminous data on aspirin, but hundreds of other phytonutrients have been found to have anti-inflammatory and antioxidant activity as well. Still, given the strength of the aspirin evidence, there are those in the public health community who talk of a widespread salicylic acid deficiency, proposing that the compound be classed as an essential vitamin, vitamin S. Whether it's the salicylic acid or a combination of other phytonutrients that account for the benefits of whole plant foods, the solution is the same. Eat more of them. Colonoscopies. The colonoscopy. It'd be hard for us to find a more dreaded routine procedure. Every year, U.S. doctors may perform more than 14 million colonoscopies, an exam used to detect abnormal changes in the large intestine, the colon, and rectum. During the procedure, doctors insert a 5-foot-long flexible tube fitted with a tiny video camera and inflate the colon with air to visualize the colon lining. Any suspicious polyps or other abnormal tissue can be biopsied during the procedure. Colonoscopies can help doctors diagnose causes of rectal bleeding or chronic diarrhea, but routine colon cancer screenings may be the most common reason they're performed. The reasons doctors often find it difficult to convince their patients to keep coming back for colonoscopies include the necessary bowel prep, during which you have to drink quarts of a powerful liquid laxative before the procedure to completely clean yourself out. There's also the pain and discomfort of the procedure itself, though you're purposefully given drugs with amnesiac effects so you won't remember how it felt. Feelings of embarrassment, invulnerability, and the fear of complications. These fears are not unfounded. Despite how routinely colonoscopies are performed, serious complications occur in about 1 out of every 350 cases, including such issues as perforations and fatal bleeding. Perforations can occur when the tip of the colonoscope punctures the wall of the colon, when the colon is overinflated, or when a doctor cauterizes a bleeding biopsy site. In extremely rare cases, this cautery can ignite some residual gas and cause the colon to literally explode. Death from colonoscopy is rare, occurring in only about 1 in every 2,500 procedures. Yet this means colonoscopies may be killing thousands of Americans every year, raising the question, do the benefits outweigh the risks? Colonoscopies are not the only screening technique for colon cancer. The USPSTF, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the official prevention guidelines body, considers colonoscopies just one of 3 acceptable colon cancer screening strategies. Starting at age 50, everyone should get either a colonoscopy once a decade, have their stool tested for hidden blood every year, which involves no scoping at all, or have a sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, along with stool testing every 3. The evidence supporting virtual colonoscopies or DNA stool testing was judged insufficient to date. Though routine screenings are no longer recommended at age 75, this assumes you've been testing negative for 25 years. If you're now 75 and have never been screened, then it's probably a good idea to get screened at least into your 80s. Sigmoidoscopy uses a much smaller scope than in a colonoscopy and has 10 times fewer complications. However, because the scope may only go in about 2 feet inside your body, it may miss tumors farther inside. So which is better overall? We won't know until randomized controlled colonoscopy trials are published in the mid-2020s. Most other developed countries do not recommend either scoping procedure, though. For routine colon cancer screening, they still endorse the non-invasive stool blood testing. Which of the three options is best for you? The USPSTF recommends that the decision should be made on an individualized basis after weighing the benefits and risks with your doctor. To what extent, though, do doctors inform patients of their options? Researchers audiotaped clinic visits to find out. They were looking for the 9 essential elements of informed decision-making, which include explaining the pros and cons of each option, describing the alternatives, and making sure the patient understands these options. Unfortunately, when it came to colon cancer screening, in most cases, the doctors and nurse practitioners studied communicated none of this vital information, 0 out of 9 elements. As Ned Toyle in the Journal of the American Medical Association put it, there are too many probabilities and uncertainties for patients to consider and too little time for clinicians to discuss them with patients. So doctors tend to just make up patients' minds for them. What do they choose? A National Cancer Institute-funded survey of more than 1,000 physicians found that nearly all doctors, 94.8%, recommended a colonoscopy. Why do doctors push colonoscopies in the United States when most of the rest of the world appears to prefer non-invasive alternatives? It may be because most doctors in the rest of the world don't get paid by procedure. As one U.S. gastroenterologist put it, colonoscopy is the goose that has laid the golden egg. An expose in the New York Times on spiraling healthcare costs noted that in many other developed countries, colonoscopies cost just a few $100s. In the United States, the procedure may cost thousands, which the journalist concluded that has less to do with providing top-notch medical care and more with business plans aimed at maximizing revenue, marketing, and lobbying. Who's in charge of setting the prices? The American Medical Association. A Washington Post investigation exposed that each year a secretive AMA committee determines billing standards for common procedures. The result is gross overestimates for the time it takes to perform common services like colonoscopies. As the Post pointed out, if AMA standards are to be believed, some doctors would have to work more than 24 hours a day to perform all the procedures they report to Medicare and private insurers. Is it any wonder that gastroenterologists bank nearly $500,000 per year? But why would your family doctor or internist push the procedure if they're not the ones doing it? Many doctors who refer their patients to the gastroenterologist receive what are essentially financial kickbacks. The U.S. Government Accountability Office, the GAO, reported on this practice of so-called self-referrals, a scheme where providers refer patients to entities in which they have a financial interest. The GAO estimated that doctors make nearly 1 million more referrals every year than they would have if they were not personally profiting. A side note on what to take before a colonoscopy. Ever popped one of those breath mints after a big meal at a restaurant? Peppermint doesn't just make your breath smell better, it also helps to reduce the gastrocolic reflex, the urge to defecate following a meal. Nerves in your stomach stretch after eating, which triggers spasms in the colon to enable your body to make room for more food coming down the pike. Peppermint can reduce these spasms by relaxing the muscles that line your colon. What does this have to do with colonoscopies? If you take circular strips of human colons removed during surgery and lay them on a table, they spontaneously contract about 3 times per minute. Isn't that kind of creepy? But if you drip menthol, found in peppermint, onto the colon strips, the strength of the contractions diminishes significantly. During a colonoscopy, such spasms can hinder the progress of the scope and cause patient discomfort. By relaxing colon muscles, peppermint can make the procedure easier for both doctor and patient. Doctors have experimented with spraying peppermint oil from the tip of the colonoscope, as well as using a hand pump to flood the colon with a peppermint solution prior to the procedure, but the simplest solution might be the best. Asking the patient to swallow peppermint oil capsules. Premedicating with 8 drops worth of peppermint essential oil 4 hours before a colonoscopy was found to significantly reduce colon spasms, patient pain, and make the scope easier to insert and withdraw compared with a placebo. If you do need a colonoscopy, ask your doctor about using this simple plant remedy. It might make it easier on both of you. Clearly, patients in America may be getting more medical care than they really need. So said Dr. Barbara Starfield, who literally wrote the book on primary care. One of our nation's most prestigious physicians, she composed the scathing commentary in the Journal of the American Medical Association, naming medical care as the third leading cause of death in the United States. Her primary care work has been widely embraced, but her findings on the potentially ineffective and even harmful nature of U.S. health care received almost no attention. Quote, "The American public appears to have been hoodwinked into believing that more interventions lead to better health," unquote, she later said in an interview. As one healthcare quality advisor noted, the widespread disregard of Dr. Starfield's evidence recalls the dark dystopia of George Orwell's 1984, where awkward facts swallowed up by the memory hole become as if they never existed at all. Sadly, Dr. Starfield is no longer with us. Ironically, she may have died from one of the adverse drug reactions she so vociferously warned us about. After she was placed on two blood thinners to prevent a stent in her heart from clogging up, she told her cardiologist she was bruising more and bleeding longer. That's the drug risk you hope doesn't outweigh the benefits. Then Dr. Starfield died after apparently hitting her head while swimming and bleeding into her brain. The question I ask myself is not whether she should have been put on two blood thinners for as long as she was, or whether she should have had the stent inserted to begin with. Rather, I wonder if she could have avoided the medication and the surgery both by avoiding the heart disease in the first place. Heart attacks are considered 96% avoidable in women who eat a wholesome diet and engage in other healthy lifestyle behaviors. The number one killer of women need almost never happen.